So today I'm with Hugh Williams, and I'm going to let him introduce himself and answer the question about where we first met and how we first met as well.
We met 3 days ago through
well, my wife's and your husband's company.
So, and the more I heard about your story, I thought, I have to interview Hugh. So the first standard question is, do you drink tea?
No, I'm afraid not. In fact, I was thinking about this, that maybe we should rename your podcast 99 Cups of Tea and One Cup of Coffee.
There have been some other cups of coffee.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought it was going to be unique.
No, there are some other people who drink coffee with me, and there's some people who won't drink tea or coffee at all.
Oh. Right.
So, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, no, I've never been a fan of tea. My wife loves tea, any type of tea, green tea, white tea, blue tea, you name it, anything with a tea in it. But no, I've never found what's so attractive about it.
Oh, but honestly, it's, yes,
the
it's
only time
lovely.
I will drink a cup of tea is with a bacon sandwich.
Mm.
And that's about it, really.
Yeah. I was going to say, what is it? Everybody who doesn't drink tea has an exception.
That's mine.
So the big question, which I'm asking everybody, is how do you respond to the statement Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping?
Tricky one, isn't it? Very tricky one. Such a big question. It's probably true. I mean, is it because it's the world has changed so much over the last 40 years? And maybe attitudes of Christianity haven't changed that much, you know? Is it? I mean, I think with the advent of technology, which is massive now, and with everyone everyone totally communicating with everyone around the world, I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity for Christianity to jump on the back of that if they haven't already. But I think it's about Christianity needing to change the way that it presents itself. I mean, my background is advertising, so I'll probably come at it as I would come at Christianity like a brand, I suppose, and thinking, you know, it's the similar thing that you get all the time, which is, you know, our brand is no longer relevant to today's society. How can we change it? And I think maybe, you know, there's an element of that with perhaps the church and Christianity today that. I mean, for example, a few years ago, I got involved with Alpha, mm-hmm. and was that at Brompton? Yeah, and they asked myself and another guy to do some advertising for them. And so again, we approached it just like a normal advertising brief, as if we were selling Mercedes or baked beans, and presented back to them. And they said, thank you very much, but oh, no thank you. And so I thought that was interesting that they obviously weren't that open to trying to. They were open to the idea of attracting new people, but when it came to what that looked like, they were very, you know, they were more closed to it. So yeah, I mean, obviously that's only one small section of it, but
that's really interesting though, because Alpha is always seen as, or has for a long time been perceived as, the way to reach everybody. But I think what we're kind of seeing now is that Alpha has reached into a particular niche of people who are the sort of people who would go on a 10-week course and
yes.
those sorts of things, and actually it's not as adaptable to other situations and perhaps the current situation as it might be. So we tried to run one where in one of our villages last year, and we could not get anyone to commit to that model of once a week for 10 weeks.
Yes.
And I think the world has moved on.
Exactly that, yeah. And I think, I suppose, that's the one thing we tried to get them to drop straight away was, you know, you've got to adapt. Just, you can't expect people to convert, that's the wrong word, but to automatically fall into line with what you want them to do. You know, if you want to attract anyone for any kind of product or message, you have to be adaptable to what they want. And I think, you know, I think that was it. Yeah, we said that, you know, the 10-week course, it sounded like a cult. It sounded like, and again, exactly as you said, you would only be attracting the people that would go on those things in the first place. So, and the whole point is you want to attract a whole new segment, a whole new market. So you have to package it up completely differently. And they at the time weren't, we basically came up with a the idea was we made a load of stained glass windows, and we put the message within the stained glass window. And so we had messages along the lines of, should we spend more time thinking about life before death rather than life after death? And, you know, and what about the here and now? And it's they, I think, as you said, that's what made me think they weren't ready to really engage with the modern world.
I mean, Alpha's been incredibly successful over the last 30 years, and loads of people have been on Alpha courses, and it has changed a lot of people's lives. And we've used it ourselves in Box previously, but just right now at the moment, it doesn't seem to be the right tool.
Yeah.
In quite a few contexts.
Well, there's a, okay, we're probably going to have to keep referring back to advertising, the sort of models, but there's a thing in advertising which is, if you're a small brand, you can either grow your own market share or grow the whole market itself. And if you want to grow the whole market, you obviously have to appeal to new customers. You know, you always have to appeal to new people all the time. And otherwise, you wither and die. And I think with Alpha, I found that it was just wanting to appeal to the easy segment, the people that were already going to be persuaded by that, rather the more challenging thing of actually attracting, say, someone like myself, you know, that would be much more skeptical about the whole thing.
It's World Cup season, and usually during World Cup season, I try to schedule my trips to busy shops like IKEA during the match times,
or JD Sports maybe, or, you know.
Yes, but it hasn't worked out that way so far, but I think it will be. I think it'll be interesting. Do you think football is a religion to some football fans?
Oh, definitely. I think it's. I think it's been said before that football has actually probably taken over from religion to become its own religion, or Christianity rather. And I think, you know, it's far more easy to understand, for one thing, which is why it's so popular. But I think so. I mean, it's, you know, there are sort of almost similarities as well, aren't you? You know, you all go to one place to worship en masse, thousands of people. There's usually an idol on the pitch that usually sometimes performs miracles, unless you're a Spurs fan like me. When there's, oh no, we've got Harry Kane. What am I saying? We're going to do brilliantly well. Well, yeah, Harry Kane is our man who can perform miracles. So yeah, I think there are huge parallels between religion or Christianity and football. It definitely is a religion, and like religions, they have their little sects and they have their troubles as well. I mean, that's human nature, isn't it? You know, I think that's where people just love to put themselves into sort of groups, don't they? And sort of, you know, and then say my group is better than yours.
I was thinking about this from a kind of anthropological point of view, and thinking about cultic symbolism and the wearing of clothes and the owning of symbols that are related to your cult, as it were, and your religion, and what that means to you.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I'm sure somebody's done several PhDs on it.
Oh, I think the whole tribalism thing. Yeah, I mean, I went to watch Valencia play Man United years ago. I happened to be in Valencia working, and so myself and about three other people went to watch this game. It was a cup. It was a sort of a Champions League match, semi-final, big match, and. And we went with this woman who was with us, who was an art buyer in advertising, and so she was very much into the arts and opera and loved all that sort of stuff. Never been to a football match in her life, so we took her along. Come on, Mary, let's go. And we stood there in the crowd and down in the corner with the hardcore Valencia fans, and there were smoke bombs going off, and there was one guy who had this enormous stomach, and on his stomach was this enormous drum, and he was beating the drum. His face was painted, and like he would beat the drum, and then the whole crowd would then just shout. You know, he was like the leader of it. And Mary turned to me and said, "Oh, darling, it's just like the opera, isn't it?" I said, "It is, until you know what they're saying." But it is. It was like a religion. You know, he was in charge. He was orchestrating the whole thing, the whole tribal thing. And it was something quite sort of visceral about the whole thing. You know, you do get wrapped up in the whole thing. And I mean, you know, I mean, I hate Man United, so I was a Valencia supporter that night. But I wasn't going to go down to that end, though. It was all very, very hardcore. But yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it's sort of. It must come back to some really sort of instinctive human thing about tribe.
So here's your hard advertising question.
Oh no, I was dreading this one. Is this art targeted just at me or the advertising community?
Well, in the whole community. How do you respond to people who say advertising is the cause of all ills in UK society?
Oh, God.
Particularly for the role that advertising plays on consumerism, gambling, sexual stereotyping and exploitation?
Oh, thanks a lot. How do you answer this one without getting sacked? Yes, of course. Yes and no. I mean, consumerism and all those things you mentioned have been around a lot longer than advertising. Advertising certainly hasn't helped and probably amplifies a lot of those problems. But I mean, the thing about advertising is that it's. I think people think it's more. It's cleverer than it really is. You know, we don't, like everyone says, when you say you're in advertising, they go, oh, you do all those subliminal ads, don't you? All those little blips and you make us buy things we don't really want. And you can't do that. And again, it comes back to human nature. All we do is, I sound like I'm the case for the defence, don't I? All we do is portray in the best way possible, best light possible, put forward an argument. That's why I like it. I mean, I was going to study law, and I think it's the same sort of thing. You're putting forward an argument, a case, and you do it in the best way you can. I mean, and I suppose being a creative, you know, you think what's the best creative way I can actually take sometimes what's a really dull subject and make it interesting to people, and yes, that work that does include gambling and things like that, and I don't agree with that. I mean. The agency I worked most of my life at actually didn't advertise cigarettes or to children, or they had a few other things. They, you know, believe it or not, advertising does have a few scruples. Not everyone, I never got involved in. I would never do cigarette advertising and things like that. But I mean, yeah, as I said, most of the time those elements have been around a lot longer than advertising. We haven't invented those things. But sexual stereotyping. I mean, that's another interesting one. I worked for a long time on the brand Dove, that came up that had this brand this campaign campaign for real beauty. I don't know if you've heard of it, where they before I was involved with it. You know, the idea was to show what they called real women in ads, and you know, and not all these sort of heavily airbrushed models. In fact, they did an ad which showed a normal woman being transformed into a supermodel by airbrushing and stuff like that. And even that was slightly even though that was quite funny, that was quite meta, because that was the advertising world pretending, looking at the advertising world and going, look at those over there, and again, actually, no, it's not. They portrayed it as a far worse case than it really is. You know, they played on people's, what people thought advertising was, and they played completely up to that. So they stretched all her limbs, they made her look beautiful, they smoothed her skin out to such a massive extent that you go, well, no one does that. You know, so that's advertising lying to itself, actually. So I feel really bad about what I do now.
What's the piece of advertising work that you've done that of which you're most proud?
The one, that's an easy one. I did a campaign a few years ago for an anti-gun crime campaign. We were approached by a radio station in North London, in Haringey, primarily played black and soul music, and that was their audience, and obviously had a massive problem with gun crime. So we put together two ads, actually, to try and sort of show, aimed at teenage boys mainly, to show the dangers of gun crime. And so we did this ad that we basically, we saw something online where you get these really high, really, really very slow motion shots of bullets going through objects. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can go through like a watermelon and you see it explode in slow motion. And so basically what we did was we got a load of objects like that, and we got a special SAS trained sort of marksman, and we filmed him shooting these objects, a bullet through, so a bottle of water, a glass of milk, some tomato ketchup, and watching them all explode in slow motion, one after the other, and then the final frame. So you get sort of, and then we put opera music over the top of it, and so you see the bullets come in and explode. You go, wow, look at that. Then the melon was the most amazing one. It sort of exploded, sort of symmetrically, like a, and it looked like a Japanese temple as it went out like that. It's an incredible thing. And then the final one we fed up is a boy's head, as in comes the bullet, but instead of the bullet this time, it's the linotype saying, stop the bullets, kill the gun. And the idea being, you get so sort of into it, oh, what's the next one, what's the next one? And you see the boy's head, you go, oh my God, because you imagine. And so we put that together, and we took it around schools in London schools, and it was quite interesting, you know, watching these kids watching this song, and they go, this is amazing, fantastic. And then as the boy's head comes up, they all jump back. And of course, you know, and it obviously he doesn't explode. And and that was we put it on the internet. It ran as a viral ad. We didn't have enough money to run it on TV, but I don't think that would have been the right audience for it or the right area. And every time there was a shooting in America, hits on this ad would just go through the roof.
Is it still on YouTube?
It's still on YouTube now, yeah. And
how would one search for it?
How one search for it? I think if you put in stop the bullet, kill the gun, you'll find it. And also the NRA got very, very, very angry with us, and they started sending us hate mail as well. So I thought, yeah, obviously we're doing something right now.
Yeah.
And we followed that one up with, they wanted another one because that was quite successful. And so we got in touch with Samuel L. Jackson, and we wrote a piece, we wrote a dialogue to camera, and we thought, we approached him and showed him this piece we'd written, and he said, yeah. He said, I only do 8 things a year, 8 including films or anything, and I want to do this. It's basically him talking to camera, dressed as he is in Pulp Fiction, in his jacket and his tie, and he just delivers this piece to camera, and it's about blame. It's about, because we did some research and found out that anyone caught with a gun or caught with the first, all they do is blame. They blame everyone else but themselves, and it's about Samuel L. Jackson's own take responsibility. You know, you blame this person, you blame that, you blame the victim for coming at you, you blame your family for breaking down, you blame this. And it says basically, you know, no, you are to take responsibility. And what we worked with him on it, because he said, we didn't know at the time, but he came from a single family. His father was killed, and his mother brought him up. And he was in the rough, he started joining gangs and things when he was about 16. And so his mother actually sent him away from Midwest, sent him to LA to become an actor, to get him out of this gang culture. And he said, you know, all my friends died. And he said, so this really resonates with me. And so he did it for nothing. And again, it's a really, well, I say really, he delivers it in such a powerful way. And again, that's on the internet. And so, so yeah, that again, every time there's a shooting, it's a horrible thing, but the hits on this go up, and the comments section is amazing. The arguments that go on there between pro-gun and anti-gun are amazing, and it's yeah. But the NRA certainly took an instant dislike to us. But so yeah, so they're the two pieces. I sort of feel that you can. I mean, advertising is from my point of view, it's creativity is about. Getting people to change their minds about something. So like that ad with the bullets, you know, you get people to see things from a different way. They go, aren't bullets beautiful the way they destroy things? So you sort of suck them in and go, yeah, they are, just like a child, you know, sort of. I think films glorify murder, don't they? You know, you see someone shot in a film and they just fall over and it's all very clean. But I think by showing how a bullet destroys things, I mean, from the marksman were a special SAS guy, or SBS, American guy. So the first thing that we put up was an egg. And he said, okay, right, so if that's an egg, you probably want a so-and-so bullet. And if I just have to sort of shave a bit off the front there to make sure that the egg bloke goes in the right way. Next thing was a watermelon. Well, that's much bigger, so you're going to need one of these bullets. And if I just shave in a different way, it'll go through. And he said, do you want the watermelon to explode nicely, or do you want it just to burst? I said, well, you can actually just kill people in lots of different ways. So, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So normally what we tend to do is, if you really want someone to die painfully, you make sure that the bullet isn't pointed. It's quite blunted. So when it goes into their body, it just bounces around a bit more before it comes out. I said, oh, this is horrible. But it's incredible. They, you know, so if they put as much thought into saving people's lives as killing people, you know, I think we'd be a far better place. Sorry, I brought the tone down a bit there, haven't I?
No, it's all good stuff.
So, yeah. So anyway, that's my favourite ad that I've done.
Did you do Mirror for Diageo? Was that you?
Yeah, the drink. Yes, it was actually. Yeah, yeah.
That was where my Google got me this morning, and I thought that was quite good.
Oh, thank you.
But
yeah.
I've got teenage girls, so it obviously hit a spot for me.
Oh right, yeah. Oh, I'd forgotten about that one. Gosh, yeah. That was Diageo came to us. Interesting. Again, they came to us to say, look, we have to do a sort of a drink responsibly. It was right at the beginning of the whole drink responsibly campaign, and so can we do one? And we said, yeah, of course. But you're Diageo. You're a drinks company. And they said, yeah. If we don't do it, the government will do it. We'll do a really hard hitting one, and that'll affect everyone.
I think I actually thought Mirror was pretty hard hitting.
Oh, thank you.
Without being gruesome.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. We didn't. Yeah, it was so easy. It's so easy just to become it becomes just too over the top with these things. But we wanted to try and just it's people become immune to these kind of messages. So you have to try and make them think.
But I thought the Mirror thing was, because that was really interesting about choice.
Yes.
And there is that choice, and that I think when you've got children of that sort of age or coming up to that sort of age, that's what you're teaching them, is actually you do have a choice in these situations.
Exactly, yeah, that's right, yeah. Rather than just hectoring them, just make them feel, draw them in, make them feel part of the conversation. But yeah, that was a good one to do, actually, yeah.
Mm. So the roundup question is, what is your favourite thing that begins with T?
Yeah, now I thought about this long and hard. Well, not long and hard, because you only gave me half an hour, but I thought about Tony the Tiger. I thought, no, that's not really it. Lots of other T's. Unfortunately, my wife or none of my kids begin with T, so that makes that the easy one out. None of my pets begin with T. So I ended up with Tasmania.
Tasmania.
Which is fantastic. Went there once with Nikki, my wife, and beautiful place, lovely. Wouldn't want to live there. It's too remote. But it was a really lovely place. Just had a really nice vibe to it, and we had a great time there. Actually, yeah, I took my daughter there. She must have been about a year old at the time, and it was just a lovely holiday. It's probably about the size of the Isle of Man. It's probably bigger than that, and we just drove around it, and it's just really peaceful. And if you go to the top of the island, I think they still actually have a Tasmanian devil. Maybe not.
I think there are some.
Yeah, I think there might be. We never saw one, but there was a room. There was a little sort of area where they were you could sort of see them. But I think they were sort of lying, going, oh, you just missed it. There it was, through the bushes. But no, Tasmania was really lovely. I'd love to go back, actually. That was because we lived in Australia at the time. So we used to go to Australia, obviously Sydney, all around Australia, and we went to New Zealand a few times. But Tasmania, just in the middle, was really lovely. So that would be my tea.
Great. So thank you very much for speaking to me today, Hugh.
That's okay. Pleasure. I hope it was as enjoyable for you as it was for me.